The following podcast involves adult language and story spoilers. Listener discretion is advised. Who is James P. Starlin?
His art elevated comic to actual art. It wasn't a comic book to me. He had storytelling, he had art.
Jim Starlin's been active in the industry since the early 1970s. His breakout work was on Captain Marvel, followed by the cult favorite Warlock. He was a pioneer at producing professional caliber creator-owned work, and he helped to launch the first Marvel imprint created specifically for creator-owned works. His Intergalactic War series, Dreadstar, has probably passed through more publishers than virtually any other privately owned concept in comics, and he's worked extensively for both Marvel and DC, as well as numerous other publishers. He is perhaps best known in comics for his creation of the fan-favorite villain Thanos, which has been featured throughout the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but most especially the billion-dollar Avengers franchise.
You read the Metamorphosis Odyssey in Epic Illustrated?
Yeah, I picked that up at your shop, I remember, and I told you how much I enjoyed it, and you're like, well, you need to read Dreadstar, especially when I got to Plan M. I fell in love with all that stuff. Dreadstar was where he was really hitting his stride. He was kind of doing the superhero storytelling, but then he was also doing his weird space opera stuff. I always felt like that's where Kenny was hitting his stride, in my personal opinion.
Without a doubt, to me, his greatest works are the Warlock Saga, the original Warlock Saga, and Dreadstars. And I enjoy a lot of the other work, but those are the two true gems. Dreadstar is, if it's not his greatest work, it's definitely right up there with his greatest work. I do think that it definitely deserves a wider audience. And it's a shame that the movie's never going to come out, the TV show's never going to come out, because of his producer dying in rehab.
Oh, yeah, I remember that story. That was crazy. When they were doing that whole Q&A, and everybody was asking them, like, about the weird and all these other fucking things, and I'm like, fuck that, dude, let's ask them about Dreadstar. Like, let's ask them something that was so fucking cool. And no one brought up Dreadstar, which I thought was really weird.
Which worked out well, because I ended up asking almost exclusively questions about Dreadstar.
Yeah.
Jim Starlin's one of the most important creators in my comic reading life. Once I knew that Jim Starlin was coming to Dallas, I was like, okay, that's the closest I'm aware of him ever coming to me. We were lucky enough to actually get to interview him briefly. I was unaware that he's no longer physically capable of drawing, because according to him, he blew a hole in his hand. So not being able to get a piece of art from him, I'd hoped to at least get to interview him. But one of the bad things with these smaller shows is that they have really heavy-handed handlers. They're brought in as a guest, and I guess they're expected to have a certain amount of time on the floor signing and helping to drive traffic to these shows. The woman who was working with him said that I can only have 10 minutes. He was really good about it. He said, look, you're helping to promote my work. You know, it's the least I could do. There was a little bleacher that had been set up, because at this particular show, they didn't have a separate section for presentation, so there wasn't anything going on at that time, so Starlin led us both up into the bleachers, and I don't know if you remember, but he was about to shoo you away because he didn't know that you were with me.
He told me that, dude. He told me that. I said, no, I'm with him, and he's like, oh, I was going to shoo you away, and I'm like, no, I'm part of this. Please don't.
You actually asked the first question. Do you recall what you asked him?
I just really wanted his take on Lord Papple. The Lord Papple character was so similar to Thanos. Dude, honestly, I was a little fanboyed out. So I remember asking, you're moving the recording stuff around, and I'm just sitting there, and I kind of dulled out for a minute, because I'm like, is he talking to me, or is he talking to the mic? Where was he talking? Who's he talking to? Yeah, I just wanted to know, was Lord Papple his attempt to do stuff with Thanos that he didn't get to do?
He was big because big is impressive looking. It was all based off on my time with Catholicism as a child and that, and the reaction to it. The Lord Papal, of course, is, you know, Papal being the Pope and the head of that. So it was more of an extension of doing another examination of religion as a negative force as opposed to a positive force, which it is in a lot of ways. It helps keep the status quo so we're not butchering each other all the time. It does have some very helpful hints, but it also has a history, especially in Europe, of being used as an excuse to kill off somebody who is the other. And so the Lord Papal and the whole Dreadstar thing, and you can include the early Warlock stories, were all sort of a reaction to my parochial school upbringing.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, my views on religion kind of came from reading your books. When I was reading I would read it, and I had that same thought. It was like, wow, religion is helpful to keep us together as a species, but it's weird when someone uses it as a reason to kill you because the higher up says it's okay and their view is better than yours. And reading those books, that's kind of what was imprinted, because I came in a house was full of Catholics, very Catholic. And I'm reading these books, and I'm just like, well, these books kind of make more sense to me than what I have to go listen to all the time. And so as I grew up, as I got to pull away from that, I kind of, it set me on my path. So I was just, all right, thank you.
Yeah, it was, you know, as you get a little bit older, you realize there's two sides to every story. And through my early grade school years, everything that came out of the church was supposed to be absolute, and it was, you couldn't question it. And I had nuns as most of my teachers through grade school. And when I finally, I think it was about fifth grade or something like that, one of the nuns was teaching us science, which, you know, right there, you're going to have trouble. And she was mostly working out of this book, and she was telling us how light takes 8 minutes to travel from the sun to Earth. And she said, so if somebody turned on a light switch, had a light switch, it would turn the sun off and on. And if they flicked it off and flicked it back on, we would have 8 minutes of darkness on Earth. And I thought about it for a minute, and I raised my hand, and I said, I don't think we would. Wouldn't we have just that time off? Because the sun that, the light was coming from the sun before would still be coming, and it would only stop happening during that time. And she went, no, it says here in the book. And I ended up getting thrown out of the class because I argued with her. And that got me to start thinking about, okay, maybe all these absolute truths that I've been told I should be swallowing whole might be worth digesting a little bit. And started reading, and, you know, by the time I hit my time starting to work in comics, I was questioning enough where it made good stories. Mm-hmm. At least I thought they were going to be good stories. Oh. And I think they worked out fairly well for the most part. Yeah.
After your work on Warlock, you embraced painting for a while there. Was that just an experiment? Because it doesn't seem... I mean, you've done some painting since then, but we didn't get to see a lot of that after the early 80s or so. Was that just a period for you?
It was a period. It was something I wanted to try. I always like experimenting. If you look through my old work, it never looks the same. I mean, from what, you know, maybe the Captain Marvels and the Warlock hat. Well, even those have quite a... because I was developing during that time. But... you know, I always like to approach things with a little bit different. And when we started on the Metamorphosis Odyssey, it was better printing, and there was all sorts of new things you could try that you couldn't have done in the regular comics, because it was limited down to a pencil with ink over the top of it. And then, you know, hand-colored by little old ladies in Connecticut, as Jim Shooter corrected me on earlier. It wasn't New Jersey. And so... when Epic Illustrator came along, we had the ability to do painting and stuff like that, so I thought I'd try it out. A lady who I was dating, who I later married, Dinah Grzunis, taught me the basics of painting. And so I went off from there, and we did Metamorphosis, a number of other books that way. Time-consuming, and you can't do that in comics. I was working, like, usually about a day or 2 days on each page. And, you know, the whole idea of comics is you got to make a deadline. And so when we did the regular comic book series, I had to return to doing the pen and ink drawings, because there was no way I was, even though it wasn't a monthly book, I think it was every 6 weeks it came out, it was something odd. Yeah. I was never going to be able to keep up with it on the paint, so that was abandoned. And later on, when the computers came along, I really enjoyed coming down at the end of the day and having dinner without having to spend an hour and a half, half hour cleaning my hands off from oil paint or whatever I was working on. Instead, I'd go downstairs and go, let's go eat.
Your earlier 70s work definitely reflected the Marvel artists that I'm sure influenced you. It felt like you were, maybe the painting influenced the evolution of your style going into the 80s and going into Dreadstar, because it was a little bit more realistic. It had that more of a classicist quality to it. Do you think that the painting changed how you approached the page?
It was more also that and also the fact that I was just learning to draw better. When I had absolutely no formal training. I came out of the service, and the only reason I got work up at Marvel is because, at the time, as I said earlier, they were hiring anybody who could hold a pencil, and I just barely qualified on that front. And so over the years, you know, I took an anatomy class from Hale up at the Art Students League in New York. That's why I started eliminating those millions of rib cage shots that I had in my early Captain Marvel ones. You know, expanded as an artist. I learned more. I thought there were some things that got lost. You know, there's not the energy in, say, like the stuff I did in the later Thanos series that there were in the first Captain Marvel, because I was 21 years old. I was hopped up. This was at the beginning of everything. And I just wanted to work, and do nothing but. And, you know, later on it became more cerebral and less gut.
When you were putting together the cast of Dreadstar, how did you arrive at that particular group of people? Where did those people come from? Did you just pull them out of your mind? Did you base them on anybody? Did it just feel like a good group dynamic? How did you arrive at that particular collective?
Well, in the Metamorphosis Odyssey, it was... the whole thing started off to be something that it never even got close to. I wanted to do a fairy tale with the Metamorphosis Odyssey. I had worked for a short time at the Bashy Studios on some of the War Wizard movies, and just a little bit on the beginning of what he did with the Tolkien stuff that never finished off. And Mike Plug was up there working, and Mike really inspired me with the beautiful paintings he was doing for War Wizards. And so I came back with this whole intention of doing a fairy tale. Unfortunately, I'm a little too dark for fairy tales, and the Metamorphosis very quickly morphed into something else that that would never be mistaken for a fairy tale. And so those characters were archetypes that I wanted to bring into the stories, because I knew at the end the majority of them was going to be changed and go off into this and be the next stage of this evolutionary thing. So Juliet, Zah, and Whispar all were created with a very finite lifespan. Akadon was the same, because... like Moses, he wasn't going to make it to the promised land. And that left me with only the dissatisfied warrior with Dreadstar. So as it continued on, they sort of grew. The story got set into a world where these experimental creatures, the people, Eddie's people, were... Willow, you know, had a fascination with telepathy. She got in there almost by accident. I think I was doing one story and I introduced this person, and I said, well, she's with him at the end. We got to do something with her. And so we turned her into a telepath. Syzygy was the magic element. He was from a side story called The Price. And so... he was enlisted out of that story so that he could become into chaos. And Skiva was just... I have more the storytelling ethos of the Marvel movies than I do the DC movies. I like a little bit of humor just to take the edge off things. Just so when the really horrible things happen, you've had at least a chance to take a little breath before the next horrible thing happens. You know, just relieve that tension just a hair.
Was it always the plan for you to wrap up the instrumentality, monarchy, war, and then be done drawing the book? Or was that just an evolution of having moved over to First and maybe change of circumstances?
I had done drawn 40 issues something at that point, and I was doing more writing. Dinah and I had collaborated on three novels that we were sold, and I was heading more toward writing. There had been many times along the way where I said, I'm just not going to draw anymore, and I'm going to just be a writer. And that never lasted. I think it's going to last now because I can't draw anymore, but, you know, shit happens. And I hope you...
No, it's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. It's a podcast. We don't have to worry about that. Yeah.
I can still remember how that music used to make me smile.
This is Rock and Roll Radio. Come on, let's rock and roll with the Ramones.
Okay. Are you going to make a new intro for this?
I'm here to talk about one song, so here I go.
Welcome to One Song Each.
This podcast is going into a song.
Whoever's with us, but usually the three of us, Diablo Frank.
Illegal Machine. Mr. Fix It.
We're going to take a few minutes to talk about a song.
One song.
Each of us will bring one song to the table.
So we're just going to pick a song and talk about it.
Choose a random song without consulting the others and without picking a theme. No themes.
Except for the times when we'll pick a theme.
We'll tell you if we're going to pick a theme.
generally speaking. Sometimes we talk about the artist's career overall. Sometimes we talk about a particular album.
You can either be technical or more intimate.
There's no prescribed link. There's no prescribed content.
Randomly pulled from our brains.
Do you play the song itself?
And we play the song for each other and then comment with a story, an anecdote.
The actual meaning of the song or more history.
Either what the song means to them or a life experience that was the soundtrack to.
What it triggers in your memory. Talk about.
All right, you guys want to hear my song?
I think it's probably one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard.
I'm in the middle of this parking lot, and I just start dancing. Next phase, new
way, that's great. It sort of became our song.
I turned up the radio.
I will never in my life forget that performance.
I want to talk about what I think is the greatest American love song. Do you like
good music? If you don't love the blues, you have a hole in your soul.
What happens when we rap about like the actual world and people are like, what?
But because of the mood of the song, it made me feel sad. I felt this melancholy. And even after the song was over with, that melancholy stayed with me.
After that, every time I got in any kind of relationship and the girl would break my heart, this is the song I crawl back to.
This is a Roll Spine podcast.
That's one song each, and it's a very interesting concept. Rock and roll and drift away.
Did you ever read Hardcore Station?
I believe so.
From the late 90s through the early 2000s, DC experimented with a way of drawing talent to their company by allowing them to create characters and concepts that they would retain the copyright to, but they would be allowed to intermingle with the DC-owned characters. Most famously, Chris Claremont had his Sovereign Seven, Peter David had Fallen Angel, and Jim Starlin had Hardcore Station, a corrupt commercial satellite with a population of several million in a free space zone between a number of trading civilizations. According to Wikipedia, the original miniseries' hero was Chief Justice Max, who was in a conflict with a towering religious figure known as Sinner, and Sinner's defeat required the aid of the Justice League of America. Later on, Hardcore Station was used as the home for DC's Captain Comet character, and in recent years, Jim Starlin has written some books that actually take place on Hardcore Station that are completely divorced from DC Comics. They're completely divorced from comic books in general. It's prose novels.
Have you ever read any of the novels he released?
No.
Yeah, see, when that first became aware that he had done novels was back in probably the late 80s, early 90s, and I would try to go to the used bookstores and, you know, all the books, Beat Alton, that kind of thing. And A, yeah. I was poor, so I didn't have a ton of money to go searching for stuff, and B, it was just whatever you could find, and I could never find them. And then it had been so many years since I thought about it that it never occurred to me that the internet existed, and I could actually go and get those books now. And most of them are available on Amazon. These were all done with his wife, by the way. Lady L is available for $3 and a paperback on Amazon. Then the Predator is available for $2 in hardcover on Amazon. Mind Games is free with Kindle Unlimited, or $15 as a trade paperback. Among Mad Men is available from $2.50. And then his more recent book, Lasgood's Boys, which he talked about on the show, that's actually available for free on Kindle or for $4 to buy.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Have you read any of it or any reviews on it?
You know, I never have. I think I'm going to try to go ahead and pick these books up now while it's fresh in my mind. I've always wanted to have them, and I know that he has illustrations in them. Apparently, a lot of those illustrations are going to be coming up in the new edition of The Art of Jim Starlin. I don't know how I managed to miss it when it first came out, because I remember the edition coming out earlier in the decade, and for some reason I never got my hands on it, and it's really expensive now. $533 on Amazon to buy an edition of the book. So that might have contributed. Maybe that was one of those instances where I was between suppliers and I may have missed it and then never got my copy. The company Aftershock is going to be putting out a new edition of it for $50 in a hardcover, which will be bigger and more comprehensive, and it's supposed to include a lot of the art from the novels. That's going to come out in May of this year, so I'm definitely going to pick that one up. Well, I'm hoping that it'll include the covers to the previous editions, because it looks like they're using the print from the Metamorphosis Odyssey print series from back in the late 70s, early 80s, specifically the image of Vance Dreadstar and Octaton that I have framed on my wall that I'm looking at right now over my computer.
Oh, wow.
So I think I
own those as well. I think I own the print. Didn't they do like a limited print release one time?
Yeah, I think it was about like seven different prints.
Yeah, I think I own some of those. They're in like somewhere in my collection somewhere. Cause I remember picking them up and just they're beautiful to look at. They're mostly black and white, if I remember.
Yeah, there's a really great black and white illustration for the envelope that I hope is in the book because I'd like to see that in a format besides my gnarly envelope that's been beaten to hell. And I think there are prints for each of the major characters from Metamorphosis Odyssey. And then the one that they're using for the cover of Art of Jim Starlin was also used for a slave labor graphics edition of the Metamorphosis Odyssey, the one that they did in black and white.
Speaking of your novels, on your card it showed something that seemed to relate to Hardcore Station. Is that you taking your creator-owned property into the prose?
Yes. Currently on Amazon you can get Hardcore Mind Games, which is the first of the Hardcore Station series. The second one is also available called Lasgood's Boys. I'm sort of treating the Amazon platform as my experimental working it together before I get myself and find a hard copy publisher. Hardcore Mind Games, which will eventually we go back to its original title, Mind Games. There's a long story on that all by itself, but that's a shorter sort of a novella. And originally they were all supposed to be illustrated novels. And Mind Games was completely illustrated before I hurt my hand. And Lasgood's Boys, we got in the middle of it, so I'm going for the prose on it now. And a good deal of the drawings that I did for these books are going to appear in an Art of Jim Starlin book that will be coming out around the time of the movie that Ominous Press is putting together. So there'll be a lot of stuff that never quite made it to where it was supposed to. You know, it was like Breed 3 and the DC Captain Marvel story that never got published. All the Hardcore Mind Games and Lasgood's Boys illustrations. A lot of things that no one's ever seen that I think they'll find interesting.
Do you have access to all those characters for comics, or is there still an issue with DC as far as using Sinner and the rest?
No. I'm not going to use Sinner because he just doesn't fit into the story, but Chief Justice Max does show up in the third book. He's the one character I wanted to bring along just because I needed a cop for one thing, and he was it. And as I've been going along, I've been thinking more about him, and so he sort of becomes a substitute character for one of the characters that doesn't make it down through the entire story. He's sort of a replacement at one point. And but yeah, it's all based off from Hardcore, because I always loved Hardcore Station, the whole satellite thing and a city built within it. And you know, any big city based on making money, you're going to have people ground up, and it's sort of a chance to do little political fringe stuff and still tell a pretty interesting story. They vary wildly. The first one, Mind Games, is about a telepath who used to be part of a crime family on Hardcore Station, managed to escape his family and his past, and been working for 10 years in on Earth as a teletherapist. He's basically trying to pass as just a shrink who can read your mind and help you out. But he gets pulled back in. Lasgood's Boys, on the other hand, by the time you've read Mind Games, you realize that the majority of the universe now is run by this corporation called Omni Ever Incorporated, which all the executives are these intelligent vegetables who run around trying to pass as human inside robes, and that it's a really miserable place to live. And shortly after they've sort of taken control of Earth, because they do this not by alien invasion or anything, they just build better mousetraps. They come in and they turn North Korea into a financial powerhouse, and it spreads out from there. And so by the time we get to this part of the story, they're running everything. But there is this one South Korean industrialist who says, you know, if we're going to get rid of these guys, we got to up the humanity's game. So he gets this biologist to build him a son that is, you know, kind of this superhuman, hyped-up character who will be able to fight the weeds on their own level. Except the Lasgood, who is the biologist, has his own agenda. Instead of one kid, he creates three boys. And they're set off to different lives. And when they grow up to manhood, the story becomes, are they going to actually do any good about getting rid of the weeds, or are they going to kill each other off first? Mm-hmm. So that's the big question in that particular story. And then the third one that we're working on now, whose title I do not have yet, I've got the whole first draft yet, and I still haven't settled on the title, is 10 years later. So it'll be fun.
At Marvel, you were really good about having your troop of players that you would move from book to book. With some of your creator-owned stuff, it seems like you've got some like lost toys out there. Weird the Reluctant Warrior. We haven't seen as much Breed. Do you own Darklaw and the Mystic? I mean, yes. So do you think there's ever a chance of you actually gathering up all these scattered characters that...
They make a brief appearance together in Breed 3.
I remember that, but it's actually been a little while since Breed 3, though, right?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years at this point. I'm sort of concentrating on the novels right now. I'm not drawing anymore, so I don't know, and I don't have any plans for any group reunion or anything. A Starlin universe does seem kind of unlikely.
No. Do you have an artist on the Dreadstar project yet?
Not yet. It's something we're just talking about up at Ominous, and we have a couple other things we're doing first.
Just a completely geeky tangent, but you created a Mongul, or co-created Mongul at DC, and I understand that that character has been more lucrative to you than Thanos, of all things.
That was a case at one point, but that has changed. Thanos is way ahead at this point.
Yeah, oh, excellent.
You know what I really wish I had asked him? Mm. I really wanted to know a little bit about when he did the DC version of Fuck with Darkseid and all them.
Cosmic Odyssey. John Stewart.
Yeah, Cosmic Odyssey. I really wanted to ask, you know, when he worked with Mike Mignola and stuff like that, like, what was the difference between working with DC and working with Marvel? What did he feel was the bigger difference between the two companies in terms of creation?
The thing that kills me is I could have easily talked to him for 3 hours. So 20 minutes is never going to do it. And that would have been a great question. There are so many questions that could have been asked, not only the stuff that you would have come in there prepared to ask, but also the stuff that came up in conversation. But you have to have the time. You've got to have the time to breathe and get it done. And one thing I got to give Paquita credit for, one of those hero moments where she's like, yes, goddess, you know, whatever, yes, queen, is the handler had only given 10 minutes. You know, we were only supposed to get 10 minutes with him. Part of what helped us get double that time was Paquita intentionally distracting the handler to try to keep her from getting back to the stands to pull Starlin away so that we would have more time. She did that on purpose as a calculation, not something we'd discussed prior to that too. So it's like, my girl, thank you. but even 20 minutes is just nowhere near enough, and I'm happy that I wasn't a babbling idiot, you know, just trying to get something out. We at least talked about some substantial stuff and definitely enjoyed the conversation.
I just want to say, you know, I love your work. It's dear to my heart. It kind of formed me as a person, for good or ill, and those are, you know, particularly the rest of our books, but also Adam Warlock's journey, definitely impacted on my life. I love the work, and I'm glad that the rest of the world to some degree is kind of catching up through the exposure, through the movies and everything else, getting to see the talent that you are. And I'm just grateful that you're getting, you know, this act where you know, it seems like the whole world's going to be waking up to what you have to offer. And I hope that carries over into your creator-owned works as well.
Yeah, it's all been very nice. You know, I'm just happy I didn't end up like Reed Crandall, the great Reed Crandall, being a night watchman over in Brooklyn in his final years. Looks like I'm going to... in this story comfortably. It's a mixed bag. You know, if somebody had approached me when I was 21 and said, after 40 years of working in this business or more, your two most popular characters, your two most popular creations are going to be a purple bad guy and a glove. Well, I might have thought twice about what I was going to do on this career path thing. But as it happens, it worked out pretty good.
Just thank you so much for the time. It's been an honor to meet you. Thank you so much.
Okay, I can see Donna coming.
Yeah, I can see she's waving us off. Thank you.
She's hurrying me back to work.
Man, he was just so damn cool to talk to. And I guess because most, you know, even when we talked to Peter David was fun, but Peter David was Peter David. We're like, I don't know. It was a different experience. He seems cool. I guess, I don't know.
He's dressed all in black. He's in good shape. I have no idea of how old he is because he looks, you know, really like together. In great shape, and you know, he was just so cool walking up the bleachers with him and hanging out with him. I mean, it felt like, I don't know, one of the great philosophers, and we're students sitting on the steps with him, you know, just enjoying, you know, listening to what he has to say and taking in his wisdom and everything else.
It really, you're equating him to Plato while we're sitting there writing on our little lambskin tribe, you know, taking in all his knowledge.
Well, I made the joke recently that I had no idea that my Mecca was going to be Irving, Texas, but there it was.
And see,
at least it was in Texas.
One weird thing, too, is usually when I try to do one of these interviews, I'll have a dense list of questions all typed up and all ready to go. And because of scheduling issues, I never got to do anything really involved. I did have like maybe a one page like guide as far as what questions to ask him. And I managed to lose that en route while we were driving up to Dallas. I knew I was going to have to wing it. And the great thing is, because I'm so familiar with Starlin's work, there's stuff that was embedded in my mind. It's so ingrained in my being and at such an early age that I know that if I ever lost my mind, had Alzheimer's or something, and lost most of my memories, I'd probably still be recalling Jim Starlin images as like the last things that would still be in my mind. So I knew that I could wing it if at all possible. But given the short time frame, trying to pull out questions, and there was a conversational flow because one thing would kind of lead into another, because that's the only way I could figure out to do it without just sitting there going, But I definitely lost my shit there toward the end and started fanboying out. Once I saw the handler coming back and basically saying, you know, clapping, saying, come on, we got to go make some money, you know, that kind of stuff. So I just sort of like started babbling there toward the end, and listening to it again, I didn't completely embarrass myself, but I embarrassed myself a little bit. But I don't mind, because I was there to worship at the altar of Starlin, and I got the chance to do that. And I tell you, I was high off of that for days. I just had a great sense of well-being just for having had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with him like that.
Well, the crazy thing is, so I was watching the sci-fi here on YouTube, and they interviewed him again. And so I'm like, oh shit, I'm going to watch him again. So I'm watching him, and they're asking him the same fucking questions everyone has asked him about Marvel, and how, you know, how does he feel about Marvel? What do they do with his character? And he almost verbatim gave the same answer. They're treating me very well. Like you know, he's already got a, you know, pat. What he already knows the questions. He knows what the fanboy's going to ask. I think in some way he appreciated that we were asking him of his other work. Because as you notice, I mean, when we were talking, dude, he went straight to his books, and he kind of lit up a little bit when he was talking about his books. Like, the conversation got a little quicker, and he became more animated when he's talking about his books. And I think that's where he wanted to go. I think he's one of those guys where he's like, I did this, and he'll talk about it for the fanboy, but he really wants you to like look at his new stuff. Like, look how I've grown and evolved.
Well, and I think that he, like a lot of creators, his favorite thing is always the thing he's either working on right now or is just finished and is still in the afterglow from.
That's where his passion is right now. Yeah, the new project.
But I definitely want to read the books. Honestly, just sitting there and feeling his enthusiasm for that work and realizing that if I want to see the adventures of these creator-owned characters to a large degree, it's going to have to be in the novels. I definitely want to pursue that now. And I kind of want to pick up these older novels too that I've always meant to read and never got the chance to. So I think that this trip has inspired another binge on Starlin material, the stuff that's gotten away from me, the stuff that I haven't had a chance to get to yet.
That's cool, man. Like, I definitely want to check out the books as well, because, I mean, he talked to them. They sounded very interesting.
The one that always got me in particular was Thinning the Predators, which was sort of a proto-Dexter where you've got a killer hunting serial killers. That always kind of struck me as an interesting track. So
we'll definitely have to pick up the book.
Okay. So any general thoughts about having met Starlin before we, you know, as we wrap it up?
A cool fucking dude, man. All around cool fucking dude. Definitely highlight in my life, you know, to get to meet him, and then him to be like, you know, like I said, it's always a little fearful to meet your heroes because they're going to be an asshole. There's just going to be something wrong with them that's going to be just, it's going to ruin your experience. And if anything, when we met him, his interaction with me alone was just like, it heightened. He went from fucking cool to just like fucking amazing cool.
Yeah, same here. I absolutely wasn't diminished by meeting my hero. It just made him seem that much cooler to me to just sit and talk with him. Just so awesome. Obviously, the people who create comic books want you to read the things. Comic books aren't meant to be precious. They're pop art. They're junk culture. But they're our culture. If you're listening to this podcast, it's your culture. Most people, when they talk about comic books, they're talking about the so-called Big Two, Marvel Comics and DC Comics. It strikes us, though, that the entire comic book industry is undervalued by the general public. As comic aficionados, we'd like to have a podcast out there that covers the entire rest of the industry, and for that purpose, we will be your underguides.
If you're sitting around and you find yourself bitching about comic books all the time and how comic books suck and how back in your day comic books were good, take a listen to the underguides, and you'll maybe open up a little doorway to some independent comic books that you hadn't read before. It doesn't have Spider-Man in it, or a Wolverine, or a Green Lantern in it, but it talks about people's lives and stuff, and sometimes you can identify with. If you're wondering where all the good writers and stuff went that don't write your comic books anymore, they're making independent stuff, so maybe we may cover it, and you may find something you can go check out.
The previous two Amazing Heroes interviews received signal amplification from Keith G. Baker, Grant Richter, Scott Rowland, Joe Crawford, Gautam Shioran, DeBeige, Ali Batts, and Derek William Crabb, as well as 20th Century Geek Podcast, 100 Issues, Alterna Comics Fan Number 1, Anthony, Anna Carey, Ange, Avatar of the Green, Badit Shapirak, Beatlemania Podcast, Between the Pages, Brooding Muse, Caroline Wells, Cash Flag, Chris at Bat Books for Beginners, Chris Sheehan, Coffee and Comics Blog and Podcast, Comic Book Vault, Comic Reflections, Comics Couplets, Comics in the Golden Age, Daniel Navasunde, David Golding, DCU Movie Page, Dr. G Nerdologist, Dwight L. McPherson, Ed Moore at Indie Comics Fan, Marvel Bronze Age, Miskatonic, Teal Productions and Urban Fantasist, Fanholes Podcast, Firestorm Fan, FKA Jason, Graphic Novelism, History of Comics on Film, I'm the Gun, Our Only Illegal Machine, James Hudson, Jeffrey Brown, JLI Podcast, Joe Crawford, Justice First Dawn, Catherine Nelson, Kyle Binning Likes Comics, Keith G. Baker, Cord Industries, Lava Hog, Luke Dobb, Martin Gray, Odell Abner Dracula, Patricia Lowe, Paul Hicks, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Randy Caldwell, Randy Andrews, Resurrections of Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, particularly appropriate for this episode, Ryan Daly, Scara, Scott Bachman, Sean Arizona, Siskoid, Slangwood Resists, Steve Sellers, Talk Nerdy to Me Podcast, Trekker Talk, Warlord Worlds, Wonder Woman Warrior for Beast Podcast, Wild Dog Podcast, Willie Yarbrough, and Xenozoic Zeta Files. Martin Gray wrote the J.M. DeMatteis episode. I've listened, and this is a great chat with a veteran whose work remains fresh and relevant. On the James Robinson episode, Odell and Abner Dracula wrote, "Scared of the JDR one, though. If I listen to it, am I hearing the Starman witchcraft guy or the Cry for Justice perpetrator?" I'm the Gun wrote, "Great interview with a favorite creator." Slangwood Resist wrote, "Nice interview. Good to hear he's got some new stuff being worked on. Still miss Leave It a Chance." And wrote, "All Supergirl fans should listen to this to hear James Robinson's thoughts on the character. Thanks, Frank." Paul Hicks wrote, "Great interview, Frank. James is always so candid and honest. I'm hugely fond of the issue of Comics Journal used for the MP3 album art. Fascinated by where James was at creatively at that time." Riley wrote, "Great episode. Really cool interview." Odell Abner Dracula came back to say, "This episode is awesome. JDR's refreshing attitude toward all ages was great to hear. And you got the scoop on his new series. Also, we are in one of those second generation Leave It a Chance households." Finally, Keith G. Baker wrote, "Another incredible interview by Diablo Frank, a modern day Brokaw." Okay, so who is James P. Starlin?
God. Actually, I assume that's what God would look like. At least Jesus. Come on, he got that kind of Jesus look. Like if Jesus were to lose all his long hair. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but
you're not recording,
like,
are you?
Like, yeah, I am recording right now.
Are you, asshole? I was just playing.